And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil. It's opening day for the Blue Jays.
It's opening day. It's
and they're losing.
So, they're well, losing. Oh, thanks a lot. It may turn out very nicely. Who knows? And we won't go into scores at this point. But we're all glad it's, baseball season is beginning. And springs anew every year. And with the Jays, you know, something good is going to happen. We're all sure of that. And, you know, ballpark attendance is up, which is I'm really happy about that. All I want now is grass. I don't know if we reach grass yet. That's what I'm looking for. Then I'll know we've achieved liftoff. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And hey, listen, you know, in 1 week there's going to be. Your Sound of the City is going to be having its membership drive. We're going to be batting cleanup. April 14 is going to be the Taylor Report date. So once you start thinking about it now, meditate on it. Today we're going to talk to Mahdi Nazim Roya, who writes at Global Research. And he's written many important books. And, of course, he's a courageous journalist. He's the man who went to Libya when NATO forces were establishing what they call the no-fly zone, but the no-fly zone included bombing Libya and bringing about the destruction of the government. And a man who was on the ground and actually living through it all was Mahdi Nazim Roya. And I think he's joined us now. Are you there, Mahdi?
Hi, how are you, Phil? I'm here.
Very good. Thank you for being with us. You have a number of important articles in recent times here, weeks, in Global Research. I noticed the latest one is about this issue of the media lens and how we understand events, and pointing out how we are, the general population tends to be manipulated by very few people who have agendas. And let's start with a big subject today, I know you are an authority on, which is probably going to be misrepresented. That is the elections in Turkey coming at a time when there is talk of possible war, that is an attack on Syria by Turkey. A Syrian airplane has been shot down about a week ago. And I notice everybody's forgotten about that. Explain to us what you think the significance would be of today's results. And by the way, do you accept that the results are going to be as Mr. Doyen describes them?
Okay, there's a number of questions that have been compounded into one another.
Yeah, I mashed them all in there.
I think we should start with the downing of the Syrian military jet, which happened on March 23rd, 2014. Mm-hmm. The Turkish government has claimed that this jet was inside Turkish airspace, that the Syrian military jet violated Turkish airspace, and it was shot down because of this. Mm-hmm. I think it's also worthy to note that the Turks also ramped up the rhetoric against the Syrians by saying that the Syrians were also trying to intimidate Turkish warplanes by putting radar locks on them. A radar lock means that they were basically monitoring them and prepared to shoot them down. But that's anybody who knows about military procedures will know that that's rhetoric, doesn't hold any water. I mean, you're monitoring foreign aircraft in case they cross over into your side of the border. And that actually proves that the Syrians don't trust the Turkish government or military.
A wise point of view.
Wise point of view, and from very proper from a defensive point. From a defensive stance. It was the Turks that a few months ago, more than a few months ago, violated Syrian airspace on a spy mission for NATO. But anyways, going back to the down jet, it's very telling to listen to what the general staff of the Turkish Armed Forces said in a release statement from Ankara about the incident on the Syrian-Turkish border. The statement's actually an omission of guilt from the Turkish side, from the Turkish military. It puts a lot of doubt on what Ankara's claims are about the airspace violation. Mm-hmm. First of all, they do acknowledged that the plane crashed 1.2 kilometers inside Syrian territory. The statement says 1,200 meters south of the border, near Kasab. And that Kasab, by the way, is a town in Syria, in Latakia district, which is also in the governorate of Latakia, and it's predominantly Christian and Armenian. And there's a lot of fighting there now, too. Anyway, so this is actually an omission, and even the pro-regime change, British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, has says that the jet was shot down in Syrian airspace. So these statements from Turkey hold no water, and in fact, Erdogan has gone out of his way with his foreign minister saying that they threatened a heavy response. And at the same time, in the same time frame of these events, the Turks started raising red flags about the tomb of a figure, yes, in Turkish history called Suleyman Shah. He wasn't really, Shah means it's Persian word for king, but he wasn't really a king. He was a chieftain from Central Asia. He was the grandfather of the founder of the Ottoman dynasty and Ottoman Empire. So because of the significance of this tomb, the Turks actually have sovereignty over it. And it's in that tomb is located almost in north central Syria. It's in Aleppo governorate. And they've said that if anything happens to Suleyman Shah's tomb in the governorate of Aleppo, which not to be mistaken for the city of Aleppo, two different things, but they said if anything happens, we're gonna intervene. So the funny thing is, the people who threatened to attack it are their own insurgent allies. You know, the people that they're giving weapons and funds and arms and training to. Yes. So, I mean, there's something really odd about that.
And by the way, isn't that a great, I mean, an opportunity, I mean, for them always to, they can play it either way they want. They can inspire, they can give weapons to somebody, they can encourage him to carry out acts, and then they can say, we didn't like that act, and now we're going to come in. It's like they give themselves an invitation.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, these events in March, you know, the apex of it all is a YouTube leak that came out on March 27th. Just a few days ago, on March 27th on YouTube, there was leaks of the Turkish foreign minister, the head of Turkish intelligence, and the deputy head of the Turkish armed forces talking about a false flag attempt. They talk about using this opportunity to basically intervene militarily in Syria, to basically attack Syria. So they talk about, now the tape doesn't say if the opportunity is an attack on the tomb of Suleyman Shah. We can infer this, we can speculate, but we know clearly that they are trying to use something as a pretext to invade. And in those tapes you hear things about how the Turks have been sending ammunition and arms into Syria, how Turkish officers have been helping the insurgents. They even talk about shooting and attacking Turkish soil themselves from within Syria and blaming it on Damascus and using that as an excuse to intervene in Syria. And what's happened because of this YouTube release, the Turkish government right after blocked Twitter, blocked YouTube. You know, it's blocked YouTube, so the Turkish public won't have access. And they're saying that this is a grave offense to Turkey and its government and its national security, and that's why it's been blocked.
Yeah, they're treating it the way the U.S. treated Snowden, right?
You're telling the American
people things they're supposed to know, particularly about it, poking into the affairs of them, and therefore we're going to arrest you for telling them. We seem to have more and more of the phenomena. Actually, now that I think of it, the Cuban Five were warning about terror acts, so they get arrested.
Well, there's definitely all these governments are trying to monopolize information. You know, the governments and major corporations try to monopolize the flow of information. Information streams are something they want to control. That's why they've done everything to control the media lens and everything to control discursive processes that influence the real world.
Yes.
You know,
by the way,
a real media war.
Indeed, going on. And And your article in globalresearch.ca, I urge everybody to please read that, because, of course, we have to read a story twice. I have to read, for example, the Star or the Globe, and then I have to see what somebody else is saying. You go to a different source and you find out, you know, for example, the Star hides a couple of references to these taped conversations, and of course they put the word alleged in front of it, and they play it down. It's not in their headlines that these shocking things were going on in the with the Turkish military, but rather, well, you know, the big story is just whether or not he's in charge, when in fact the rest of the world, not readers of the Globe and Star, they're hearing about these conversations and wondering if they're going to be driven into a war.
You know, the other things that our media, like in Toronto or the rest of Canada, won't talk about are things like how one of the people in Ukraine that we support, Yulia Tymoshenko, is talking about killing all the Russians. You know, these are things that we won't hear because there's clamps on the discourse of what we're allowed to hear and what not to hear. I listened to the CBC yesterday. It was pretty disgusting. You know, I haven't watched it I barely watch it now or listen to CBC radio. CBC radio is much better than television, but it's been a while that I've been listening to it less often than I usually would, and it's because the blatant propaganda or ethnocentric views that don't represent the real world, that are unobjective, and the irony is that they demonize the other media and say that they're unobjective. And I do agree that most media networks do consider, they have their own, they carry a certain agenda. But back to the incident in Turkey, these leaked conversations, what's very important to note is that there has been an internal fight within Turkey between Erdogan within the AK party, his Justice and Development Party, and between the Gulen movement, which is tied to a preacher based in Pennsylvania.
Let me just mention, I'm so glad you raised this, because I just before coming to the station read an account of the speech today by Erdogan, and suddenly in the middle of his speech, which people found apparently very incoherent, he said, these Pennsylvania people better look out. And I thought, Pennsylvania? What's he talking about? Now you're going to explain.
Okay. Well, the thing is that in Turkey, there's been a movement that was founded by this man. It's very influential. It's not only in Turkey, actually, in northern Iraq, in Central Asia. They've been kicked out of places, I believe, in St. Petersburg, Russia, there was a case. They've been setting up schools, all sorts of networks, and in Turkey they have a lot of influence. And they run the prep schools, they did until they were shut down. Erdogan and them had problems over Kurdistan. The Gulen movement, which is run by this preacher, who many say is he's very old, and it could very well be someone else is really running the organization. But anyways, this organization is said to basically be a way for the United States and the CIA to try to influence events in Central Asia and the Caucasus around the Caspian Sea. So
is it because this is an inter-Islamic quarrel? I mean, Erdogan wants to be the Islamic leader, right? He makes references to the Ottomans, and
he does. I mean, there is a neo-Ottomanism policy. He wants to see Turkey as an imperial. He wanted to at least see Turkey as an imperialist policy. Him and his foreign minister, who coined this phrase, neo-Ottomanism. It's really capitalism. It's Turkish capitalism. That's what it is. Expanding Turkish economic and political control in the Arab world and the Mediterranean. But Gulen is a little different. I mean, this man opposed the... he supports Israel, number one. He was against Turks sending aid to Gaza. And this is what I wanted to point out about Kurdistan. Erdogan, business comes first for him. I mean, faith is something he hides behind. So he wanted a peace agreement with the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party. And a view that he had is basically a federation between Turkey and the Kurdish regions. Maybe even northern Iraq would be included in this. But he wanted peace, and the MIT, that's the Turkish intelligence, was running the initiative. And what happened was the Gulen movement opposed it. They opposed it, and they actually did everything to derail it. And they exposed it, and they worked against it. And this is when you started to see a falling out between them begin. I mean, that's not the only thing that's happened between them. There's been a long series of leaked conversations. What I think is important to note is these leaked conversations are the basis for them is true. Some of them might be manipulated. Mm-hmm. I mean, edited to some extent, but they are true. The AK party is corrupt. But that doesn't mean Gulen is not corrupt either. It's not some pious organization that he runs.
We're speaking to Mahdi Nazim Roya, and on that point, I've been struck by how what we call leaks have all stood up very solid. I mean, actually, for the most part, the big ones in recent weeks here, and some of them are coming from RT.com, which I notice now there's a movement in Canada that wants to knock out RT.com, because these people like Tymoshenko had to come forward and say, well, yeah, I said that, and I'm sorry about the using curse words. And you say, curse words? It included nuclear weapons. And the Ashton conversation, for example, with the foreign minister, I thought, well, that is a very strange story, but I noticed it held up.
Oh, yeah, it did, definitely. I followed Ashton's discussion with the Estonian foreign minister.
I forgot to say Lady Ashton to make sure I show respect.
Well, I don't see her as being my higher or my peer. You know, I don't refer to anybody as sir or lady. I think we're all equal. So I'm glad you didn't call Lady Ashton. Yeah. Catherine Ashton, I mean, that tape was released by Ukrainian intelligence. I think that the other leak between the Assistant Secretary of State for Europe and Eurasia, Victoria Nuland, a neocon, by the way, married to one of the founders of the Project for a New American Century.
Mr. Kagan, right? Robert Kagan?
Exactly. I believe that one was probably released by Russian intelligence, and they were probably holding on to it for a while. But one assumes
they've got a few items that they could share with us when they feel like it.
Well, and the State Department also pointed the finger at the Russian Federation. But the point is that those things are real. Well, the first one pointed out, one, that the United States is behind regime change in Kiev. That's a fact. Regardless of what if the Russians did is appropriate or not, that's a fact that exposes the lies on Washington's side. And number two, it puts the sniper story into question. In fact, because of that report, I looked at my own work in regards to snipers in Syria, in Libya. Do you have the same type of cases where snipers were killing both sides? I actually looked at a book where I published a chapter in, and I clearly point that out in the case of Syria. I mean, these snipers were killing people on both sides. And what's very important for us to note is the Ashton tape, when the Estonian foreign minister is talking to her, he mentions a lady by the name of Olga. Olga is the head doctor for the Euromaidan protester. She's no fan of the government. She was against Yanukovych. Okay, so this is one of the activists. This is a doctor who worked on the side of the opposition, who's saying that I believe that there's more to these snipers. They couldn't be government, and you know the teams there have seen that the shots are coming. The people that killed policemen also killed the activists or whatever protesters. I mean, the protesters were manipulated. It's very clear. And I'm certain that the United States government and the main opposition leaders, including the current prime minister right now, big scoundrel, he's the illegitimate prime minister of the country, of Ukraine, were part of the sniper shootings. I'm very certain about it, of course.
Yeah.
I can tell you, because the CIA was actively involved there. The head of Ukrainian intelligence testified about this.
Yes. Well, of course, Victoria Nuland boasted in public meetings that they had been putting a lot of... I hate the figures.
$5 billion.
Usually when you put $5 billion into subversive activity, you get some results. A little bang for the buck, as it were. By the way, this is Mahdi Nazemroya, author of The Globalization of NATO and the War on Libya and the Decolonization of Africa. I'd like to explore that. What I've found strange, or many striking things about this matter with Ukraine, is that they had unhappiness beginning last November with the elected president, whether anyone liked him or not. He was the elected president. Very few people in the United States liked their presidents in recent decades. They almost all are unpopular. But at any rate, there were demonstrations, and then there was an agreement. And then suddenly in the middle of the night, there's a great deal of commotion, which nobody has ever given us any detailed account. And then they say, well, we have a new government with this gentleman, what's his name? Yats. Pardon me, yes. Victoria Nuland calls him Yats. But anyway, Yats is in power. What I want to know is, if it was bad for the elected president to make a deal he didn't even make a deal. He said he didn't want to go forward at this time with the deal with Russia. Okay, so you're unhappy that he said that, so you overthrow him. And then this man who hasn't been elected on that ticket of opposition heads to Washington and Belgium, and he starts signing agreements that are totally different.
How do you do that?
Where's the legitimacy of that kind of behavior?
This is a foreign appointed government. There should be no mistakes about it. Whether you support Arseniy's Union Fatherland Party, which is run by Yulia Tymoshenko, let me say, is the most corrupt person in Ukraine. So-called gas princess who monopolized gas, impoverished Ukrainians, stole, used her government positions. You know what? These people, we should have some historical memory here. Yatsenyuk, he comes from the party that was in charge of the country before the ousted prime minister. They were not popular. Their presidential candidate, one of their allies within the Orange Movement, he only got 5% in the first run of the presidential elections. They had to have a second run after that. But these guys mismanaged the country. They impoverished it through the agreements they signed earlier that was similar to this. And they didn't get reelected, and that's how the Party of Regions won. I agree that the ousted president is a crook and corrupt. Yeah, mm-hmm. They're all corrupt. That's the problem in Ukraine, is all the politicians are corrupt.
Yeah, they're right about the oligarchs. It just turns out that our oligarchs are revolutionaries and good guys, and your oligarchs are not, is the way they seem to argue.
Yeah, exactly, and then they appoint these guys. That agreement, this entire protest started, one, because Yanukovych and the Party of Regions, who originally were going to sign the European Union Association Agreement, realized when they saw the fine print that they're going to lose their corporations and their billions. You know, they wouldn't have thought it was a problem if the rest of the country was impoverished, but they noticed that the agreements would essentially allow for an economic takeover of Ukraine by European Union corporations. They would have to change the regulations and let them come in. So they didn't sign that. They said it's economic suicide. We're not going to have any indigenous industry. You're going to take over our industries and everything. That's why they stopped the sign. Otherwise, they were promoting it. And then the opposition leaders used this as an excuse for these protests. That's how the protest started. Of course, there were legitimate reasons why a lot of grassroots people didn't like this government. There was also illegitimate reasons, because some people were like, oh, this government is, there's too many ethnic Russians in it, or, you know, we need to be nationalists, we need to be part of the European Union. There was those type of reasons, too.
Well, and by the way, they have an unresolved language question. There's been some dancing on this subject. They first said that Russian would no longer be an official language.
No,
then they all blushed, and the president said, oh, I'm going to table that. However,
that's still on the table,
apparently.
Hold on. That's not the president. Let's call him what he is. He's a coup-installed figure. They say he's the acting president. That's the head of the parliament.
But he certainly changed.
He's not the legitimate president. He did block it. You know why? Because half the country, or even more, speaks Russian.
Well, it'd be ungovernable, right? However, my point there, and I want to ask you, is that my understanding is, as of today, the question, while it's been put on the shelf, has not actually been dispensed with, and it matter that there are powerful people there who intend to see if they can eliminate the Russian language as an official language.
Well, first of all, I want to clarify something. It's considered a regional language. It's not considered the official language of the country. It's just the terming of words, right? Mm-hmm. It's on a regional level. It is official in certain regions, in particular the East and the South.
Well, and there's also Hungarian and Greek.
Yes, I was going to say that as well. Those languages are also, it's not just Russian that they want to ban from usage. Yes. It's also those languages. Greek in particular, as well as Hungarian. In fact, there's been a falling out between the Hungarian right wing ultra-nationalists and the Ukrainian ultra-nationalists over the issue. So, I mean, they still want to do that. You have people that are talking about Ukrainianizing the country. They're looking for people that are ethnic Russians. You know, it's a very dirty mindset. It's very dangerous. You know, we should remember the causes of World War II or some of the reasons that were used to get fanfare for invasions. And this type of nationalism is one of those factors. Mm-hmm. You know, so you have Ukrainians talking about getting nuclear weapons and attacking Russia.
Yeah, elected members of their new parliament.
Some of these people have been there for a while. You know, the neo-Nazi, one of the neo-Nazi parties, Svoboda, 10% of the seats in the Ukrainian Rada or parliament is those neo-Nazis. They've been there.
Moderates. I think they're now the moderates.
Well, we try to hide them because they're good Nazis, right? Yeah. They're the good Nazis. Harper doesn't mind them. You know, our foreign minister who has problems reading a piece of paper. You know, I've watched him speak. Whenever it's a written statement, the guy can't even read properly. Him and Stephen Harper, you know, they support these Nazis. They don't say anything about them. But why should we be surprised when we support Al-Qaeda in Syria or Libya? It just goes to show that whoever we support is based on our interests. It's not based on any moral.
The moment you support them, you call them moderates.
Yeah, the moment you support them, they become... And for some reason, we deny, regardless of what international law says or if we support sovereignty or not in Crimea, we deny the agency of the Crimean people, and we try to say that it's some Kremlin plan to take over Crimea. That referendum was initiated by the Crimean people. They wanted to leave Ukraine since...
Well, since the beginning, and nobody ever asked them in the first place.
Since the beginning. Personally, I think that the timing for the referendum, from a strategic point of view, is good for Russia. But from another point of view, from a legal, political point of view, I think that it wasn't the right time because there was a void in Kiev, a governmental void. But that's my personal opinion on it. Yeah. But I want to point out the absolute hypocrisy of people... in Canada, including in our opposition parties, which many think...
they're all unanimous.
They're unanimous.
There's no argument.
They don't. They supported Kosovo independence, which had no referendum, by the way.
Yes, I noticed that Obama had that wrong. He actually referred to a referendum in Kosovo that never happened.
There was no referendum. We created a government there, and we let them actually decide on it. Yeah. It was their government decided on it, but it was a government we created. Right after NATO went in there, we set up a government without asking anybody, on the pretext that ethnic Albanian Kosovars were being persecuted. Let me tell you, that entire problem in Kosovo started with the first victims being Albanians who were being targeted by the KLA. Most of the civil servants and bureaucrats in Kosovo were Albanians because of the demographics, and they targeted them to get them to leave the government. So they didn't. They targeted the Albanians were actually being targeted by the KLA. And another fact is that NATO is the one that killed more Albanians than Serbs. I'm not saying that Albanians weren't killed by the Yugoslav army on law enforcement and internal security, on an internal security mandate that eventually emerged because of the KLA. But the fact is that we killed more Kosovar, Albanian and Serb alike, than the Yugoslav army. But well, all these things we brush aside. We brush aside the elections and the referendum and the Falkland, the Malvinas. You know, the British had a referendum there. They brush it aside. We brush aside the referendum in Sudan. In fact, Obama recognized Sudan, South Sudan, as independent before a referendum. And look at the mess there now.
That just shows his powers of intuition. He knew what they were going to do. We're speaking, or have been speaking now, to Mahdi Nazemroy. He's the author of The Globalization of NATO, where I think you will find many of the arguments you've heard today outlined and with all the footnotes that you require. Mahdi, we're very grateful. Look forward to talking to you again sometime soon.
Thank you for having me, Phil.
Okay, no. Mahdi Nazemroy and globalresearch.ca to find his articles.